Welcome back to the Convos podcast. As you may have noticed, this is the start of a new series called Cognitive Convos. Cognitive Convos will be dedicated to more abstract and conceptual topics. In this first episode, I had the privilege to talk with Wayne McPherson about Kaizen. In short, Kaizen is a Japanese philosophy on continuous improvement. Wayne is from New Zealand and he currently holds the position as the director for the management program at the Massey Business School. However, he has lived and worked in Japan for 2 decades where he encountered Kaizen. Enjoy the episode to see how this journey unfolded and learn about Kaizen. For reference, this episode was recorded on August 11, 2020, a day before any new cases were announced in Auckland and New Zealand went back to alert level 2.
Right, so Wayne, first of all, thank you for accepting my invitation for this interview/podcast episode.
Yes.
Just a brief intro. This is recently started a podcast, and for some context to the listeners, the topic we're going to talk about today is Kaizen philosophy.
Sure.
It's a pretty, it's a Japanese philosophy, but we'll talk more about it once we get into it.
Yes.
But first of all, who are you? So I did some quick reading, some intros on what you put out online,
okay.
LinkedIn. So from what I got, you did your undergrad here at Massey University.
That's right. Bachelor of Business Studies in International Business,
Banking
Finance.
Finance and Banking,
yeah.
That's
right, yeah.
And then you moved to Japan for a few years, so a few decades.
2 decades, yeah. I believe, yes.
And yeah. Now you're here back as the director of management for the Massey School of Management.
That's right, yeah. So in Japan, I did a master's of, oh, sorry, I, what did I do? Sorry, I've just lost my train of thought here. So I did, yeah, did my master's degree there, Master of Commerce in Japan.
Yeah.
So that's actually a Japanese university, all in Japanese, sort of back in the day before the sort of the, you know, the internationalization of Japanese universities, and came back to New Zealand here in 2016.
Cool.
So the School of Management, and then yeah, lecturing international business, and also Master of Management directorship here. So
what got you to go to Japan in the first place? Being a, you know,
good question. Yes. So originally back in the 80s, I actually enrolled here at Massey in 86, and I worked in finance and also did my undergrad study at the same time. And when I left, graduated, Japan was the big, it was, you know, the Japanese economy was booming, and you know, business studies and international business was all about Japan. Somewhat, like, I guess China somewhat today, not so much. You know, we don't really look to China for, you know, what is, you know, the secrets of, you know, successful business. Back in when I did my undergrad in the 80s and 90s, then, you know, Japan was the place to look. You know, all, you know, case studies were about Japan and the different, the big names that came out of there.
So you saw a direct correlation at what you studied and saw an opportunity in Japan. And
that's what it was. Go and have a look for myself.
Yeah.
Sitting here in Palmerston North, you know, we're a long way from everywhere. You know, the rest of the world basically is concentrated in the Northern Hemisphere. So it was an opportunity to, you know, go abroad and have a look. You know, I graduated, I'd sort of,
yeah,
end of a chapter. There were options to either, you know, continue studying, get a job, travel, other. So I decided to travel.
So from finance and banking to doing your master's in commerce in Japan,
yep.
What was your first impression, I guess, in Japan compared to New Zealand?
Well, I did my master's in commerce, so this is in logistics, so Pacific Basin logistics. So it sort of tied into the international side of my studies. And it was things that I could see, you know, the trade, the import, the export between New Zealand and Japan, and that was my interest. Getting to Japan, it was just like, wow. Like, it was, let's call it for what it's worth, utopia. Everything worked, everything was bright and shiny and new, and it just worked.
Is there anything that comes to mind that, you know, sticks out as, you know, something that was radically different compared to what you were used to?
I think, well, if anything, just the population density is the biggest,
yeah,
the first thing you see. But just that everything works. You know, the streets are clean, the trains are on time, you know, you put your hand up, a taxi arrives, everything's somewhat automated.
Yeah.
But it's also got that very much that human touch at the same time.
And that was in the 80s, yes. Like late 80s,
yep.
Already.
Yep. Wow. Exactly, back then. I'm not sure when the two came together,
yep.
The automation and the human side. Prior to that, I'd imagine it was a lot of hard work, building the economy and the products and what have you.
Yeah, I think especially after World War II, that they had a real boom.
Boom time, didn't they, all through there? Yeah.
But from my knowledge, unfortunately, now the Japanese economy is kind of stagnant, as in...
Stagnant is the word. It goes into decline, 1% here, then it gains another percent in the following year, so it's, effectively a zero-sum game over the last, 20 years.
Yeah.
Going into 2000s, the first 10 years, there's stagnation there, and they called it, the lost decade. And now we've come up to 2020, it's another lost decade.
So you are there at its prime?
At its prime, and then I guess effectively the crash.
Yeah.
The economy turned over in 91, 92, which is when I arrived. But I didn't see or feel any downside, no. It was still golden years that it had been. Maybe that's just where I was in the country, in the economy, and that. I wasn't downtown Tokyo where people may have been losing their jobs.
Yeah.
Or out in the regions and that.
So what area of Japan were you exactly?
So I originally arrived in Tokyo, as everyone else does, with a working holiday visa, with a 1 year ticket to ride and see what I can and do what I can. And I went up into this Nagano area, which is famous for skiing. That's in the Alps, the Japan Alps. And I worked for a season there, snow grooming. So you see it when you went skiing the other day, the big tractors. With the tracks, and they sort of plow and smooth the snow over when people are off the field. So I was doing that, working at night and skiing during the day. So that was my first season. It was a good balance. I was in Japan, but I was sort of out in the mountains, very similar to New Zealand. So really
pretty close to home.
And great snow.
Amazing. And being there, when did you, going to the topic of this conversation, encounter Kaizen, walk us through the journey?
True, okay. It's quite a long one. It's just one of just lucky turns, if anything. So I finished my season on the ski field, and then the whole company was taken down to southern Japan by the company that was running the ski field. That was back in the days of lots of money. And chartered an aeroplane, chartered buses, and went right down the bottom of Japan, down to Kyushu Island.
Mm-hmm.
And we stayed in a place called Kagoshima, which very much on the tourist map as well, for people traveling to Japan. And then we went to a place called Miyazaki, and it was part of the tourist route. And it was when I arrived in that little city, it was a small city of 300,000 people, which is sort of big by New Zealand standards. And it was on the beach, it was pumping, it was a lovely, clean, it was just a great place to be. So I went back. I came back to New Zealand in May of that year, of 92 I think it was, graduation here at Massey. And then I jumped on a plane and went back again, basically intending to spend some time there. A little bit of surfing, learning the language, learning the culture. So I did that, and I spent a year and a half there in the end. Managed to find work. And then I actually was going to come back to Japan. I come back to New Zealand somewhere at one stage. And then I decided before I came back to New Zealand, I'd spend a year in Japan studying the language only. Minimal work, but actually concentrate on the language.
So in the first few years, the first year that you were there, how did you communicate?
Some people spoke English.
Yeah.
I learned some Japanese, and then of course a dictionary in between. So it was before iPhones. So I went to a city which is at the north end of the Kyushu Island, Fukuoka. And that was the intention was to be there a year. And just before I was going to come back from that and come back to New Zealand, I was talking to one of the Japanese teachers, Japanese language school. And she said, well, if you're going to go back to New Zealand and do your master's, why don't you stay here in Japan and do it here? You like the place.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, that's a good idea. So I found out about the local university, did the entrance exam, got in, and then started my master's.
Yeah, cool. How difficult was it to learn the language
I think the whole place for me was quite a buzz. you know, I was really excited to be there, as opposed to this is a chore.
Yeah.
So learning the language, you know, new words, new grammar, it was exciting. But also realized the whole, the grammar sequence, grammar order or sequence is reversed between English and Japanese.
Mm.
You know, the verbs at the end as opposed to...
Yeah, because I'm trying Chinese now and I see similar things.
Exactly.
I was looking at, I wanted to learn a new language, Chinese or Japanese. Eventually I, you know, lean towards Chinese, but Japanese still interests me, so...
Right, yeah.
Checking.
So I had to learn that and I was on the goal of learning the language,
yeah.
You know, to be part, enjoy, you know, the country and sort of be part of it as much as I could. So from there, I finished my master's and then I actually started working in the Japanese industry in Panasonic.
And that was the Masters of Commerce that you...
That's right, yes. Okay. So I spent a decade working for Panasonic, and there we translated it like international or global development team. So it was part of the internationalization policies and, you know, development initiatives of that company.
Yeah.
And of course, walking around the company and the factory and through there, there's everything was TQM, this and Kaizen, that. And I was like, what's this Kaizen? What's this TQM business? Haven't heard of it before.
Mm.
So I looked into it a little bit and, you know, sort of the discovery of like, this is possibly what, you know, the secret of Japan's growth and success is all about. And I start asking
questions
and reading and learning more. So, and of course, the Toyota way, you know, the Toyota is all about Kaizen.
Yeah.
They sort of say that's their DNA and that's where their growth has come from, their success. So like, okay, this is possibly the success of Japan. This is what I'm interested in.
Yeah, that's what I've read. It started to really pick off in the automotive industry, right?
That's exactly
as
right.
As in optimizing the processes. And I think I read something of this during one of my assignments last semester.
Yes, yeah. That's what it's all about, rather than repetition of processes and resources and that. Optimization, you know, efficiency. And of course, right down to the, you know, the final, you know, one item or whatever it might be, 1 second, or just shaving, you know, the unnecessary off.
So, in layman's terms, really simplified, how would you describe what Kaizen, the philosophy, is to someone who hasn't even heard about it?
As a philosophy as a whole, it's, I guess, everybody banding together, you know, the individual doing their best. You know, if something needs to be done, they do it. If there's a way of making something better, they do it. So rather than like leaving things as they are, just continuously looking for ways to improve everything. And it doesn't have to be, you know, in the industry. It could be the way, you know, you cook your breakfast, or it could be the way you go home. Instead of going here, maybe if we went that way, it might be, you know, take some time off, it might be safer, it might be something. It doesn't have to necessarily be financial gain.
Yeah.
You know, there are lots of different gains to consider. So it's all, and they refer to it as, you know, continuous improvement, as you know, an English or Western translation, which is, you know, correct. But it's not just the processes of continuously improving and striving for quality.
Mm-hmm.
It's the whole mindset. You know, you start to identify things that need to be done and actually doing them.
So during your time in Panasonic, was it when you encountered? What are the things you noticed that like piqued your interest from the employees collectively? How did they?
Definitely.
Their attitudes.
Attitudes, yeah. Were that they're all as one. Everyone was working for the one team. You know, it is. It's a Panasonic family. It's a Toyota family. People live it. A lot of people, they come through the university system. That might be their first and last job. And of course, the company also nurtures the individual. You know, what do you want to be? Do you want to be an engineer, a manager, or whatever it might be? And they'll put you on that path. And the company stretches even back towards the family. Your children have, you know, particular celebration. You know, the company will acknowledge that. Your children graduate from university or maybe high school, they acknowledge that with maybe.
So it's really inclusive to
not just the employee, but also their family.
The relationship.
Yep. Yep. We would often get an email saying somebody's father has passed away, somebody's mother has passed away. So, and you know, if you knew the person, you could send condolences. If not, you could ignore it. But it goes right back to, you know, the number of generations away from the employee.
And how do you think that affected or influenced that improvement, continuous improvement thought in the people?
Well, I think because it's their family, and of course you want to do the best for your family, don't you? You don't want to hurt your children or you know, spouse or you know, the home you live in. So you're always looking to make things better, you know, your environment better, which of course repeats onto yourself, makes yourself better. So you're seeking self-improvement and improvement in your environment, and it can be like processes or places or people.
And that basically benefits the company as a whole.
The company, exactly. That translates into, you know, better products, better sales and better profit, and which returns back to the customer, sorry, to the staff anyway. You know, sustainability, and that's something that, you know, assurances they have a job next year or next, you know, decade even.
So would you say that it's really more like individual, personal based, and then the focus on like the collective?
It does work that way, yeah. It's got to start with the individual. If the individual doesn't buy in, then there's no action, is there? You know, you can sort of try and sell something to somebody, but if they don't want to buy it, you can't sell it. So once they're bought in and they're actually part of the, you know, the group, and they're making, rather than reactive action, more proactive, they're being proactive in their activity. So they're actually like suggesting ways to improve and just making improvements. It could be in their job and it might go unnoticed, but I did it, you know, I made an adjustment to something, and it works well for me.
How did you buy in, and vice versa, how would you get somebody to buy in?
I think the reason is because I was in Japan and I'd seen, I guess, the wealth, if you could describe it that, the success, you know, the companies, you know, you go back to World War, the end of World War II, Japan was basically at a zero. You know, the country was devastated, infrastructure, everything like just annihilated through the bombings and, you know, the results of war. So they've gone from zero to where they were when I saw them in, you know, the 90s. At that time, they were, still are, possibly in effect, number two economy in the world. You know, China has slipped into number two economy purely because of size of population.
Yeah.
Now, China has, what, 1.3, 1.4 billion people. Japan has 120 million. So it's 10% of the size, but it's the third largest economy in the world after, you know, America and then China. The others may catch up. India will probably catch up. Indonesia, those all the larger populations. But Japan had a very small population, and coming out of the war, no resources. You know, there's no gold, there's no oil, there's no steel on, you know, in country there. So everything had to be imported, and of course processed, and then of course exporting.
And you're an island, so
on an island as well.
Logistics is even more complicated.
Exactly, everything has to come by sea, which, you know, is not cheap anyway. So the only resource they had were the people.
Mm-hmm.
So the way to build the economy is around the people. What can you get out of the people? You know, people, we see them as, you know, they work. You know, labour is the first place. Now, labour is fine for a certain period. You know, you get to use their hands, their muscles, you put them to work, they'll work, but there's only to a certain level or threshold there. But then you realise, and the Japanese did, they also have a mind, have a brain. So if you can plug into that, you get the, you know, the brain and the hands working together, you know, there's a synergetic effect, and then you get the individual, and then they work with the group, and of course the whole nation.
Mm-hmm.
So it comes from a strategic, probably a conversation, you know, in, you know, parliament and or wherever it might have been in government, you know, during the war or whatever. So, you know, the Japanese said, we will be number one.
Mm-hmm.
We've lost the war, but we will beat America economically. And of course, the whole country got behind that. We're going to be number one. We're going to beat these Americans. These Americans are amazing. Like, look at the firepower, look at their economic development. We're going to beat them. And they went on their journey. And they almost made it.
Yeah.
Mm. This is amazing. Considering, you know, America is, what, 330 or so million people.
And looking at the sheer size of resources.
Resources on in the country, yeah. Whereas Japan didn't have that. The only resource, water and people.
So in a sense, it's also that isolation and being like detached from the rest of the world that forced that cultivation of looking inward.
Exactly right. Yes, there's no neighbours, are there? You don't have to deal, you know, worry about looking over your shoulder about what's happening there, bored of conflicts or anything. But yeah, you know, you're on your own. You know, so sort of like Galapagos, things develop independently. And New Zealand's the same. It's a unique country. Japan's the same. It's, you know, very much unique in that respect. Yeah,
I was just about to ask about the resemblances that you see in New Zealand, but before that, the second part of that first question, how would you get someone to buy in to Kaizen?
Good idea.
Imagine me now, you know, I just heard about it,
I think it comes down to the individual, you know, your individual development. You make yourself, and you can be, you know, very average, or you can actually, you know, set yourself a goal, you know, strategic intent, and actually go for something. Make yourself something and realize that you can be something. And the other thing too, you have to realize that you are where you are today, and, you know, you may not be here tomorrow, but you're not the CEO of the company. You know, you're the whatever of, you know, the company you're in now. If you want to be the CEO, you've got to plan that journey. You know, you hear stories about a lot of young people coming out of maybe university or going for their first job. They want to be the boss. It's like, no, you start here and you work up and you learn the processes, and then you can be, you know, the leader at the end of the day. So the Japanese, they know their place in society, and, you know, they're happy with that. Society deals very well to everybody. Even the homeless people, you know, are well looked after in that respect. So it comes down to the individual. You've got to sell it to the individual that, you know, what can it be for them? What is the benefit for them? And it's not just about finance and how rich you can be. It's, you know, the growth of the person. And then you can get that buy-in, and then that journey begins. Because it has to start with the individual. Even I've seen within companies that the management have come up with a new strategic initiative, and if you don't get buy-in, you know, at the individual level, it won't happen.
Yeah.
You've got to get that.
Doesn't matter how great the plan is.
No. The people aren't there, and it literally happens in their hand. You know, it's the operator who pushes the button, or, you know, the people turn up to work or whatever. You've got to get, you know, right down on the individual basis. That's where all the hard work starts.
Okay. Well, we'll see later on.
Okay. See if you can find somewhere. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, and now back to New Zealand. Similarities, both are like an island nation, detached from the rest of the world. What are some similarities, but also some radical differences that you've noticed between these two, living in both, having lived in both?
Right. I think with a radical difference, New Zealand is a very much, well, what we call radical difference, but New Zealanders are quite reserved. They're happy to be where they are. And just to sort of keep sort of like trundling along. They don't really have aspirations. Some do, but I think as a nation, you know, New Zealanders are generally a happy, you know, group of people, and happy sort of stuck down here, the, you know, the bottom of the world, doing what they're doing. The Japan, in that respect as well, their isolation is also an important factor. But at the same time, Japan also wants to get out into the world and be part of it. New Zealand, you know, we're happy to provide people with food. You know, dairy products and that sort of horticulture. We supply a lot of natural resources, primary produce, whereas for Japan, you know, those resources weren't available, so they've gone to the secondary and tertiary side. You know, production, you know, the very high-tech electronics that we all know. So New Zealand's, you know, happy to stay down the bottom, you know, the primary industry. We haven't sort of thought, how do we add major value? How can we transform these particular resources into something more valuable? We're content. New Zealanders are very content with what they have.
Why do you think that is? As in,
I think it's just we're in paradise. You know, can you make it any better? Is probably the big question. Everyone would like a little bit more money, but everyone here, you know, it's prosperity in its own right, I think. But Japan, large population, people living, you know, the population density is very high in the cities. So things have to be, I guess, precise. Is possibly a key word, that, you know, there's no waste, whether it be waste of resources or waste of time. Whereas in New Zealand, you know, we can waste resources a little bit. We've got that sort of, you know, give and take.
We're looking at the geographical and just the space available. Yeah, Japan really is calculated because the rooms are like all.
It's down to, you know, centimeters.
What I've seen.
Yeah.
And what stories I've heard from friends who went, it's just really small, like. If you go to a motel or hotel, they have like these beds that you like a pot and just sleep in.
Yep, exactly. So everything is that precision, that what are you going to do in this particular hotel? Well, I want to have a shower and I want to go to bed. Okay, that's all we're going to give you. Whereas in New Zealand, for one person to do have a shower and a bed, it's a big room.
Yeah.
So it can, if you look at it that way, that's a waste of resources. You know, a pod would be suffice. But New Zealanders would say, no, we want a little bit of luxury, or, you know, we need our space. So I think precision is probably a word you're looking for there. Because through precision, you're not wasting. And of course, when you have limited resources, you can't be wasting them. Whereas in New Zealand, let's say we have unlimited resources in that respect.
Yeah.
So we tend to waste. So we're not always looking for that, how can we make it better mindset.
Would you say that's also because New Zealand hasn't been cornered or backed like Japan has?
I've heard of that as well, that New Zealand's never been attacked, on the archipelago here. So that's possibly something that's, whether there's any effect, you'd have to talk to other people. Their countries have been attacked, some through war or some of the economics or whatever it might be. Is there an impact on the people to become, maybe it's defensive or aggressive, whatever it might be? But New Zealand, we haven't had that. Mm-hmm. We've gone to war in Europe, for example. So everything's far away.
Yeah.
There's never been anything.
The people haven't felt the impact, direct impact.
You're right. So, I want to say the hearts are pure in that respect. But that might be an old adage anyway. The Japanese, I'd say their hearts are pure. They're very nice people. They're reserved and generous. There's no aggression that you see. You get the odd, one or two sort of thing.
Yeah.
But that happens everywhere. But overall, if you travel the world, you go to different countries, and you can sense stress or tension or the people's character. And the characters are different across, different nations and that.
And they're very disciplined.
Very so.
Is that, could you place that under the Kaizen umbrella and being brought up from little, that they're being brought up like that, being taught that philosophy?
I think it comes out in the teachings, because where my thesis sort of delved into, back into Chinese Confucianism, and then you look at Japanese Shinto and that sort of thing. The different, it's whether philosophy or religion, whatever you want to refer to that, it's embedded in their culture and embedded in their lifestyle. So sort of you look at a philosophy through to culture, through to lifestyle, through the individual, and some sort of step process there, then the children, I guess it comes out of it, let's say it might be the Kaizen philosophy or the Shinto or Buddhist philosophies, that the way that you teach your children.
Could you quickly explain what Shinto is?
Shinto is the national religion of Japan.
Mm.
It could be sort of like similar to like paganism, very much in touch with the land, the forests, the mountains, the rivers. Sort of a Maori approach to like the world as we sort of talk about now in New Zealand, as opposed to one centric god, like Christianity has the one god, for example.
You just mentioned the Maori. Would you say that the Maori, especially given their religion, way of life, would be more similar to Japanese than the Westernized theories?
I would definitely say so. It's more that, if you want to use the word indigenous, which people like to use, there's more in touch with the spirits of the mountains, spirits of the lake, spirits of the river, for example. So in Japan too, rivers have life, mountains have life. You're talking about Mount Fuji. It's a mountain, but that's a god. Mm-hmm. That mountain is like the national, it's a treasure of the country. And people see it's like, yep, that's Japan, sort of thing. So it incites a pride in an individual to be, I am Japanese, for example. There's Mount Fuji. And I guess that sort of brings the people together in that respect. So the people are very, in that respect, disciplined, which of course, you get the other, you get courtesy. It also, all those sort of facets work together. If you find out where they come from, that's what you find in Shinto, for example, Buddhism, Christianity too, for what it's worth, Confucianism as well. So it's all driven, through those philosophies, and of course that sort of comes out in the culture, and of course into the people as well. So the children are taught in school, but it's not like, for example, Buddha said this, God said this. It's not that way. So, can you do this, please? Or, respect your elders, but they're taught to respect as opposed to told to respect.
Yeah, it's like cultivated.
Exactly, it's a cultivation, it's a nurturing. of the individual to be, you know, a member of society. Whereas in New Zealand, it's like, kids, outside now, sort of thing. Whereas in Japan, it's like, okay, kids, you know, you'll sit down, you'll do this. Mm. So there's more that nurture. It's a longer time frame that, you know, the parents maybe look at, or, you know, the society looks at. The kids go to kindergarten and they're carrying bags and books, and yeah, you know, we think, oh my gosh, poor child. Yeah, but they get fit into a little framework, and, you know, they can't leave it to get lost, and they sort of grow up. People see the negative and call it robots, maybe, or like ants.
Yeah, I was just about, because that seems kind of like negative, being like programmed in a sense.
True.
So,
if anything, you're giving them sort of boundaries in which to work in, as long as the boundaries aren't too narrow, and which some of them do become very narrow. You go to the big cities, and even like you go across to China and like Shanghai, Beijing, the kids work in a very narrow, wake up, go to school, go to cram school, learn this,
the
learn
hours
that.
They put in, it's like tremendous. True. So do they get burnt out? Like,
they do, especially the pressure comes on, the pressure from school to achieve in the exams, pressures from their parents to actually achieve in the exams as well. So the boundaries become very narrow. You know, and in Japan, it probably works through Asia, and that if you can get into the right kindergarten, you will go to this university and you will get a job in this company here.
So it really starts at
kindergarten. Whereas here in New Zealand, say, probably depends on the university you went to as to
the people,
opportunities you meet, and of course where their alumni are working, what companies they're running, for example. So that sort of gives you a bit more, well, that's your options there. Massey University versus, say, Waikato University. Yeah. You know, the people are, you know, alumni are different. Whereas in Japan, it's the kindergarten. It starts at that level. Because, you know, the kindergarten, the whole education system is maybe one school group.
Yeah.
And that school group may be run or owned by Toyota, for example.
Mm,
I actually wrote a paper on that. It's all about managed education. There are schools in Aichi Prefecture, which is Nagoya through there, that some of them owned by Toyota, but other ones, even the public schools, are very heavily influenced by Toyota, as in, you should teach this program, this would be an ideal way to, you know, educate your children or what have you. So the company is effectively nurturing the children.
Yeah.
For the company.
How big would you say Toyota's influence is in Japan society?
Depends on what region you're looking at.
You've mentioned it several times.
Yeah. Toyota, definitely. It's the epitome, I guess, of Japanese industry, Japanese excellence, Japanese quality. You know, they do it. And even now, you know, we're having this pandemic, but Toyota's, you know, they're in the black.
Yeah, and I think it was a few months ago, I saw that they're planning to start a Toyota city, like being self-sufficient everything.
Yeah, it's just a massive conglomerate in that respect. But it's built through, you know, this you know, discipline and efficiency, and all through their productivity and what have you. Mm.
And how does that relate to them from the private sector, like working with the government? Are they
hugely important?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because those companies are so big, you know, they can influence, of course, in a negative way as possible, but it seems to be in a positive ways. You know, they give back a lot to the community. And the people are happy. You know, they can, if I get a job at this particular company, I have a job for life. And that's what Japan pushed, I guess, during the 70s and 80s even, you know, a job for life.
So pushing for that security and being
exactly.
not having to worry
about, you know,
the future.
We won't make you rich, but, you know, you'll be comfortable. And if that's enough for you, then come and work for us. And that was okay until about now. But, of course, you know, the internet and the people are realising, wait a minute, you know, people in America or New Zealand have a lot more freedom. Why don't we have that? And so, of course, in Japan it's starting that the corporates were built on this lifetime employment.
Mm-hmm.
But that now the lifetime employment is actually starting to destroy the corporates. Because the individual employee is like, wait a minute, I want to go and work for a foreign company because I could get transferred, I could change my job, I don't have to wear a suit and tie every day, maybe jeans Friday, whatever. There's a bit more freedom and freedom of expression. So, you know, the Japanese corporates were built on this lifetime employment. Now the lifetime employment is actually undoing them.
So, yeah.
They have to change.
Yeah.
They have to become more Western. But by being Japanese was the key to their success.
It's also part of their decline.
Decline, I think. Yeah. Can Japanese organizations be Western and be successful? And that will be the big question, I think. Maybe Toyota is
and
doing something.
That
would
be explained of because being more accessible to the world, because they get more information.
True.
Being
yes,
more exposed.
That's what it's about. It's the internet, if anything. Yeah. There's more exposure, international travel.
Yeah.
In the past, Japanese have gone overseas, on holiday to return to their job. And now it's like, wait a minute, I could actually get a job overseas. The TV sort of gives them ideas and that, movies and what have you. Like, the world's becoming more accessible, and not just a visit, but actually to go and live there and be part of it.
Okay. Mm. Cool. So coming back to, you spent your time in Panasonic.
Yep.
And then for a decade or so.
That's right. Yep.
And you came back in 2016.
So what happened there? So
you got exposed to Kaizen, and then next?
I did my DBA. So that's the MBA, DBA, so Doctor of Business Administration. And while I was doing that, then Japan went through a restructuring. Panasonic went through a restructuring, so my job was moved up to headquarters, and I was living away. My wife and I and family didn't want to move, so basically resigned. And then I moved into academia, so I was working in the Japanese university system there, teaching international business and politics, more sort of Western business side. So that I was there for 5 years, and then prior to 2016 we returned. My two girls are saying we want to go to school in New Zealand, and the pressure came on. Can we go? Have you got a job? And like, okay. And so in the end, we made it work. Lucky to find a job here at Massey.
Family forced you back.
Yeah, it was family, yes, the children. Yeah. So we moved back, and then of course, as you know, I teach international business. I've taught strategic management as well, and now Master of Management program. I think that's so. But my research continues into, of course, Kaizen. And Kaizen, especially in times of crisis, because that's where it came out of. We in New Zealand, we try to do Kaizen and incorporate the Japanese philosophies into our organisations when things are good, when times are good. When times are good, you don't really need to change. When it's crisis, you have to change. And we've seen it during this pandemic. Things we wanted to do were difficult. But now the university tells us in this case, like, well, if you want to do it, just make it happen.
Yeah.
Okay, so things are a lot easier to change during the crisis event. So, of course, Kaizen comes in at that time as well. It's like, okay, let's make change for the better. How can we actually do what we wanted to do? So, and Kaizen, in this case, saved Japan, pulled them out of that post-war, could have been a depression. They didn't. They hit the ground running, and, of course, did very well. I've seen other companies as well, almost heading towards bankruptcy, that picked up Kaizen programs in Japan and have turned their companies around, and the results are amazing.
When you came back to New Zealand in 2016, did you have to adapt to anything having lived in Japan for so long?
You're right. I'd call it a culture shock. A reverse culture shock, yes. So. And I'd had also coming back, over the years, people always ask, why do the Japanese do this? Why do they do that? And so coming back to 2016, I was here permanently and such, and people would say, oh, why do the Japanese do that? And I'm like, no, that's not the question you should be asking. The question is, why do you do this? For example, why do the Japanese take their shoes off? It's like when they go inside their house. Like, well, why do you leave your shoes on when you go inside? Shoes are for outside, it's dirty. Why would you want to bring that dirt into your house? And I'm like, you're right. Things that, we have this, they have a shower at night.
Yeah.
Well, we have a shower in the morning. Okay? Not all of us, but just saying. Fundamentally, you look around in the morning, people have got wet hair, make the assumption they've had a shower, and you talk to people didn't see the showers in the morning. You spend all day out in the city, you're grubby, and most people would probably go to bed, wake up the next morning and have a shower to start the day with a shower, right? You should have a shower at the end of the day, wash it away, and go to bed clean, right?
Well,
questions to be asked.
Well, back home, it's like in the morning and in the
evening. Even better. Yeah. This is even better. One at night, and of course, one in the morning.
Well, this is something I've noticed in Europe predominantly, that
the morning.
Right.
The day. I only have it in the morning.
You've seen the heavens. Yeah. So, but that's, you've gone to bed with the dirt from the day before.
Doesn't make sense.
Yeah. And the Japanese people are very clean in that respect. Very clean, they use a lot of water. I realize it's a small country, nation state, very large population there. They have a lot of water, a lot of mountains, so they trap a lot of water and then they recycle and what have you. Just an interesting thing that to show you how Japan does not waste, every night they have a bath.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone has a shower, jumps into the bath, relaxes. The next morning, that bath water is used in the washing machine. Now the bath water is not being soaked in like New Zealanders would jump in the bath with the bar of soap and sort of wash in the bath water and get out. They actually shower, clean off and then relax in the bath. So that water's still clean. That's used in the washing machine the next morning to do the washing. So the water's recycled.
So are any of those, let's say, cultural activities that you carry them over, do you still practice them?
Well, we practice a lot of them at home, definitely. Of course, taking your shoes off is something new.
Yeah.
We eat a lot of Japanese food, so of course we like to use chopsticks rather than knife and fork. Chopsticks, you can have chopsticks in one hand and a drink in the other, is also very handy. Just the way we do, we bathe at night, we have a bath, a lot of things like that. It's pretty, somewhere between a Japanese and a New Zealand culture. The best of both worlds is what we select, don't you, where possible.
Now, let's come back to Massey. So you did your undergrad here at Massey.
That's right.
Did that past relationship have any, added value of you getting a position here in Massey, or did you look elsewhere?
Originally we were thinking of going back to Auckland. Going to Auckland. Because we were living in Japan, Fukuoka City is sister cities with Auckland.
Big city.
Very simple, big city, 1.5 million, bay city. Fukuoka is a really good city, easy to live in, very convenient, expressway, subway, and all the business. So it was, I guess, naturally we'd go back to Auckland. But we went back to Auckland, it's like, Auckland doesn't work. Traffic jams, and just like the efficiency of Japan was not repeated in.
Because the systems are the same.
Different, Even though they're sister cities and they're both bay cities and all the business, not the same. Mm. They're working on a population basis and maybe a geographic basis. But fundamentally, the infrastructures are very, very much different. Maybe Palmerston North is more closer to, Fukuoka. The ease to get around. So maybe imagine Auckland, because a lot of people know what Auckland's like anyway.
Probably go during the break. Still need to experience.
True. That's what you have to do. Yeah, but within Auckland, they've got an expressway around the city. So you can be anywhere in the city within about 10 minutes. Whereas in Auckland, it takes an hour to an hour and a half.
Wow.
We don't know why.
Because of the traffic.
Exactly. The infrastructure. Yeah. They have the problem, they know what it is, but they don't solve the problem. Whereas the Japanese, we have a problem, how are we going to solve it? And even when someone says we can't solve it, someone goes, solve it.
Yeah.
And of course they have to, and they do. Very sad.
And then you decided, back to Balmy, hometown.
Yes. I was back on a visit and sort of mentioned that I wouldn't mind coming back to New Zealand. And then I got an email from the Massey Business School saying, well, if you're interested, we do have a position available. If you'd like to interview for it, send us your CV. I was like, perfect.
Yeah.
So I sent it in. And that was in about April, and in May I did my interview, and in June they gave me a letter of offer, which I accepted. In August we moved out of our house in Japan, and September 1st I started here. So it was in half a year.
Everything
changed.
Did the management position already, or the program already exist prior to you coming here?
No, I originally came in as a lecturing in international business and strategic management. And at that time, there was a Master of Management program, but there was no directorship role.
Mm.
So it was just a program, the business studies degree. They're sitting there, they're running, but there's no director overlooking them. And so the PVC, or Pro Vice Chancellor here, decided that we actually need somebody to sit at the top of each program and actually look, just check things strategically and make sure everything's right, they're aligned to university strategy. They're aligned to what the market needs, you know, what the businesses need. And so that's what my role is. So he created that role. He didn't create that role for me. It's just timely that that role was created. And then I was working as a senior lecturer.
Yeah.
And then it was like, basically, if anyone's interested, please apply. I'm like, well, that sounds like fun. So it's not a full-time job, it's a half-time job. So my lecturing job is also half-time. So that makes, you know, one full-time position. So I'm half in the School of Management and half in the College of Business, which one, you know, umbrellas the other one situation.
Well, to my perspective and observations, in a sense, that position is a way that you can, you know, implement the Kaizen philosophy.
Absolutely.
It just matches perfectly.
It does.
What really spoke to me is previous semester, this semester, that I saw you had regular meetings with especially the students, getting feedback.
Always just talking to them, and getting suggestions. That's the Japanese way. Management talks to the workers, or, you know, I realize it's a hierarchical, but, you know, what's happening? What do you see, you know, in your job? Whether it be on the workshop, outside, whether it be marketing, what are you doing? How can we be of assistance to you? How can I do something for you? What do you need? And I ask those questions, and it's not of other staff, but actually of the students.
Mm.
What do you need? And it's sort of, you know, implement that. So it's a strategic job, it's also operational as well. You know, finding out what people, seeking suggestions, because that's where the people operate.
Yeah.
So, and of course, you can't always see what, you know, what happens in their daily lives. And if they can tell you, then you can sort of implement different initiatives in there.
Are there any challenges doing it from Palmerston? Because the Palmerston group is pretty small, the student base, compared to the Albany group.
Mm.
And I assume you also have the Albany group under your management, right?
Yep,
so
yep.
How do you deal with those two, like the small focus group and the more widespread, bigger group?
Good
and
question.
At a distance, especially.
Yes, I have very good staff up in Auckland that do assist in that. Pre-COVID, I was traveling every so often and, you know, meeting with different groups, keeping in touch. But with the COVID, you know, less and less travel. But prior to that as well, we were looking, because the Auckland campus had grown, and of course the Manawatu campus is sort of like, you know, decrease in numbers quite a lot. There's an initiative to actually regrow the Manawatu campus here at Massey, but of course COVID's come in and sort of put the brakes on that. We're sort of sitting in limbo for the next year or 2 years, you know, what's going to happen with international students. But on the ground here, anyway, domestic enrollments are increasing. So, you know, I realise the international students have dropped off, but domestic students are increasing. I guess, you know, it comes with the times when economics are good, people go to work, and when the economy is down, people go to study. So we're going to see a lot more students coming in. They'll go to Auckland, but they'll also come to Palmerston North because they're not just from the regions.
Yes.
So regional people do not want to go to Auckland, it's just too much. So they'll come to Palmerston North and do their study here, hopefully. That's the intent. Yeah. So it's COVID's got its, you know, there's the sort of silver lining in there somewhere for us.
Speaking of silver linings, what are like one or two things that you've seen come out of this whole, you know, being backed into a corner?
I think it's a good opportunity to reflect. People were like, we were sent home. I remember when COVID all started off, we were told, you know, go home by next Friday, and then the Monday of that week, so I'd go home today. And then we went into full lockdown on Thursday. And of course, we were down for, 6 weeks? I realise other countries have been locked down, others haven't been locked down. But especially in New Zealand here, like, it was go home, stay home, and basically, you know, I think it was a lot of time to reflect on what we do and what we don't need to do. So it's effectively the Japanese thing again, like, what's necessary and what's a luxury? And, you know, you can do without the luxuries at any time. What are the necessities? You know, how can we create efficiency within our lives here and make things better for us?
Yeah.
You know, do we need to travel overseas, or can we travel domestically? Do we need to buy that, you know, second car, or can we, you know, live with one? So it's sort of thinking about what you really need, what you really want, and working on that.
So you could say that the reflecting is a big part of Kaizen. As you previously mentioned as well, during times of crisis is when you actually need to practice it fully.
Yes.
And during the good times, it's not really necessary.
It's not necessary, is it? Because you've got, there's money there, there's leeway, there's you know, a lot of waste comes out of good times, which then, of course, lead to bad times, possibly. Yeah.
But would you say during the good times, if you're not practicing it, that you get out of touch with it?
True, true. And that's where, in Japan, because it's part of the culture, it's, you know, it's sort of ingrained in the people, that even when, you know, times are good, they still practice it. Whereas maybe in the West, things are good, who cares? You know, we don't need to save money because we've got lots of it. And then when the money runs out, oh, we should start saving now, but you don't have the money to save. So even like, speaking of savings, the Japanese save money. Incredible. You have to have a look, but the Japanese post office has some ridiculous amount of money in it. The highest savings rate in the world, I believe. But of course, and that money there is being used to create infrastructure within the country, and that, you know, trillions of dollars in savings for such a small but large population. That. So, do people reflect? You know, the people improve themselves. We do it during the bad times, we reflect, but they do it during the good times as well.
Yeah. And I see, I guess, more Western society businesses are trying to adopt it, in a sense. Mm. I heard from this philosophy from actually a friend in the Netherlands.
Okay.
So, it's pretty, I'm not sure how popular it is there, but you see people trying to adopt it. Is it that easy to adopt by the West? Or let's see, what are, I guess, challenges that the West could meet? And how could they?
Yeah, I can see it. Yeah, it, or I can understand that too.
Get the best of both worlds, as you said, New Zealand.
How would you do that? Yeah,
try to get that balance.
I think up until now, a lot of countries and a lot of companies have gone to Japan and they've gone on company tours. You know, there are tours. Go and have a look at, you know, company XYZ in Japan and see how they operate. And we go there and they show us what they want us to see. And we go, well, they do this. They have a whiteboard, or they have these charts, or they do something. Let's do that. And initially, you know, in the West here, we make the savings. But it doesn't continue. And the Ben Kaizen program set up by the government here, tours to Nagoya, Aichi Prefecture, we know, home of Toyota. And the people have gone there, they've come back, gung-ho, yes. A year later, not continuing. There's no continuation here. Because it's a great program, but it's not seen as a way to work or a way to live. Whereas the Japanese live it.
Yeah.
It happens, and you don't just have Kaizen at work, you have Kaizen at home. You have Kaizen, you know, in your sports team or in your other hobbies and that. Whereas for us, Kaizen is something that happens at work, which is not the case. It should be everywhere.
Yeah.
So it's something that you have to...
It's a lifestyle.
It's a life, you're right, absolutely. And it could be anything. When you go home, don't take your shoes off and just leave them lying on the ground. The best thing is what we do at home. You take your shoes off, you step up into the house, and you turn your shoes around the direction that you're going to go. Because when you walk up to your shoes, you just put them on and walk outside. You don't have to then bend down, turn them around, because you just want to walk
it's
out.
It's optimizing that
little things like that.
In the morning.
You come in, while you're down, you take your shoes off, turn them around. So when you come back and put them on and walk out the door quickly situation. So it's all about, it's efficiency. Not in a, what's the word, I wouldn't say a sick way, but you know, just little things like that. You know, how can you sort of make things a little bit better, improvements in there?
That brings me to an interesting point. I've read a lot of articles from, not know if you're familiar with James Clear.
No.
He's an author of the book Atomic Habits.
Okay.
And he tries to hack, figure out how to create habits and optimize them. In a sense, I think he also wrote an article about Kaizen. He explored different Japanese philosophies.
Sounds like
he's
onto that idea. Yeah.
Like Shoshin, having a beginner's mind,
yep.
And all those things. Are there any, what do you as an individual, let's bring it to the individual level now, do to, you know, optimize or create these little habits? How do you do them?
Too serious. Well, I think what I do, I set myself like rules or standards. They don't have to be, you know, rules of the land. They don't have to be standards that may be, you know, very high, for example. But this is the way I do things. It's almost like being a perfectionist. You know, when you put your books on the table, you know, they've got to be straight. I like to keep things neat and tidy. And in the Japanese workplace, things are always neat and tidy. So, you know, where's the spanner? Where's the screwdriver? Well, it's going to be there because it's where you left it.
It's always there.
It's its home. So everything has a place. And the Japanese people understand. They know where their place is in society. So they know where the tools place is in the workshop, for example. So everything has a place in that respect.
Are there any like routines, habits that you start your day with and end your day with?
Just the way, you know, sort of waking up, you know, you need to check the news or things like that. And just, I think everything has, you know, we're very much into routines.
Yeah.
And of course, by the routine, you know, how long it's going to take. So, you know, oh wait, I'm running 5 minutes late. I'm going to be out the door 5 minutes because I have the same routine. So very much, you know, very much routined in that way. And when we come home, you do this, you do that, and we get, you know, dinner on the table at a certain time. And the children have a bath, you know, in a certain order. It's not military, you know, sort of, no, it's not that, that extreme. But, you know, you go first, you go second. Okay, I know that when you, you know, drying your hair, I can now go up and have a shower, for example. So the kids get to learn, you know, I guess signals. So signals come out during, well, when we come home or in the morning, time to do something. Okay, this has happened, it's time for you to go and get your bag because, you know, I've gone out to the car or something. Okay, it's time for you to get your bag and head out yourself. So there's a lot of signaling that goes on, as opposed to mother going, okay, you know, pack your bags, do this. Like, I know I have to do this now.
And that's, I'm glad you mentioned that signal. It's something he mentions in his book as well, like creating cues.
Yes. Yeah, same idea.
That happens.
Yep.
Okay, you can act upon that.
Yep.
So if you would, like a simple way, would like to learn something, do something, what are ways that you would create these signals just to get that habit adopted?
I think, yeah, it depends on if it's for myself or for somebody else. Sort of observe.
Let's imagine for yourself.
For myself?
As an individual, seeing how, you know, for me it's interesting to see how different individuals do things.
Right. So I think it's observe the environment around. You know, something there is signaling for me to do something. Whether it might be, for example, you know, a lot of people gain weight, for example, at a certain time of year with winter or something. So, you know, you watch your weight. Oh, wait a minute, I've hit a certain number. Okay, now it's time for action. Yeah, things like that. Could be that. For the children, they're introducing something new into the household. When this happens, or maybe mummy goes, that means, just little things like that. So you observe from your environment and create those little cues. Now, English language, maybe, you know, Western languages, very highly content driven, aren't they? You know, you say what you mean, whereas Eastern languages are very much contextual. What I say is not what I may mean. So I say something, but you know what I really said. That's sort of, you know, contextual, right? And the Japanese language is like that. It's not what you say, it's what you don't say that's important.
Does that not cause for miscommunication, especially if it's with someone from the West?
That would do, and that's fine. But when it's between two Japanese people, then no, you won't get that. You know, it wouldn't work that, because when you're dealing between East and Westerners, we'll say whatever, you have to be very much content driven, don't you? But even I've had it working in corporates and that. For example, this weekend, I've been told by the boss, this weekend, Saturday, we're going to basically walk around the factory or around the company grounds, and we're going to clean up all the rubbish, you know, in the local neighbourhood. It's purely voluntary, but we will all be here at 10 o'clock. You know, you don't have to come, it's voluntary, but we will be here at 10 o'clock. It's like, they and I am in the group, I will be here at 10 o'clock. You coming?
Yep. You feel like you belong, so you have to be part of the activity.
Voluntary activity is not voluntary. Probably anywhere the truth is known. And then even in New Zealand, you know, it's a voluntary organisation. Not very. You know, there's compulsion, because you want to be part of that community. Yeah. And part of that community is, you know, actually joining in the activities. But they say voluntary, so no one's actually pressured, and there is an escape clause. But
the contextual underlying message is
exactly right. Yes.
Okay, just going through list if I missed anything. I guess Yeah, to wind down a bit now. We've had a long conversation.
It's been good, isn't it?
Yeah. Are there any like books, reading, resources you'd recommend to start this for someone who wants to explore the philosophy, or just in general to help improve their lives?
Yeah, I think sort of the work by Nonaka. We sort of had a look for his particular name. And the other one is, there is the Toyota Way.
Nonaka.
Yeah.
How do you spell it?
Nonaka.
Nonaka.
That's
really...
Yeah, if you've
got Japanese,
that, and then, you know, Kaizen, it was easy to find. Yeah. Rather than, the other one too I'd suggest for people is to read the Toyota Way. It's actually written by a Japanese, originally a Japanese author, translated into English. I've actually in the process of, I have both versions, so the Japanese version and the English version. So part of my research is actually to translate the Japanese version, or actually not so much, I call it translation, real-time translation. I'm reading between the Japanese and the English, just sort of like comparative analysis. Review of each, one against the other, the English mainly of the Japanese, just to see how well the translation is, because the Westerners are going to come and read the English version, are they getting the right message?
Yeah, I was just about to get, even in translation, because you said it's a language,
get lost,
doesn't anything get lost during the translation and just, it's out of context basically.
It does, I'll tell you that. That's coming out of my research now that I'm still working on. I can read the Japanese and that is not what they say. Sorry, people, you got the wrong message. And then, that'll come back out of the research as well. It's like, well, this is what they said, and this is what you read, and I know that you understood it this way, but let's look at the difference here. You can see why you missed the boat.
Yeah, it
happens at times. Whether it's intentional or mistaken, I'm not sure. Whether it's just, you say different mindsets, content versus context-driven, it's a possibility. But, two people can have the same conversation sort of thing, and, we can misunderstand each other very easily, very so.
Oh, cool. I know that those, I'm going to check them out. And I guess to close off, is there any, final message? Basically anything you'd like to...
I think what I'd like
to share
your viewers, people are very interested in a wide range of topics. I think have a look at Japan. Jump on the YouTube and have a look at the videos. I think for me personally, New Zealand's a lovely place. It works really well as a very natural, green, untouched, that's the way to describe it, country. Whereas Japan is very much developed. I think Japan's done it right. Maybe it's biased, I've sort of spent two decades there and I like the place. Maybe it's biased, but I think Japan offers a view of what the utopia that people are looking for. They're looking for economic development, they're looking for safety, cleanliness, they're looking for efficiency, quality of life. And I think Japan, honestly, provides the best place to actually view that. So if your viewers and anybody, whether our politicians even, have a look. If you're gonna build a highway system in Auckland, go to Japan and see how they did theirs. Go, okay, now we have an image, and take that home and then build it based on your own context.
Okay, and as a final, since you mentioned go visit Japan, is there, any underrated place that you've experienced that you'd recommend? Let's say I'm going in 2 years.
Japan, I think the image people have, especially they see Tokyo, see concrete jungle, not the case. They have that. But it's not a concrete jungle that's barriers. It's very easily, can easily transit through the jungle as such. But the mountains, the beaches, the lakes, the rivers. Japan has so much in the way of natural wilderness.
Yeah.
It's incredible. Considering the industry that comes out of there, the high population, small land area, incredible nature. It's amazing, beautiful country.
Is there a particular area that comes to mind?
It depends on what you want to do. You want to go to the beach and surf, or go to the mountains and ski. But I suggest Kyushu, the lower island. Yep.
Okay.
It's a different, slightly different culture. The southern versus the central versus the northern.
Yeah.
It's like New Zealand. It's a long, thin country. Auckland is different to Dunedin, maybe.
Yeah.
Different cultures, different histories and what. But for me, Kyushu was a great place. Very good food. Lots to do, lots of fishing and surfing, a little bit of skiing, you know, good drinking at the same time, and really, really nice people everywhere. So that's what it's all about. It's a great place to visit, but you have to wait till after COVID, unfortunately.
Yeah, no. Awesome. Yeah, I was planning to go there with a couple of friends, but...
Everything's on hold. Postponed. True, unfortunately, but more time to do some research and more, you know, learn more about it, where to go and what to see.
Yeah, definitely. Wayne, thanks for...
Thank you for having me. Yeah.
Thank you for sharing your knowledge.
You're welcome.